Hi everybody, this is BitViper. The episode you're about to hear actually was recorded quite some time ago, and due to some confusion, it actually overwrote episode 62 that was done by Will Jason, because he did the same topic, or at least I did the same topic that he did, and it was thought that my show was actually his, so it was actually put in his place for about an hour, where about 10 people or so downloaded my episode instead of his. Well, we eventually figured out what happened, and we switched it correctly to his episode. And so those of you who have heard the show you're about to hear before, go ahead and go up to twattech.org and download episode 62, which would be his version, because he has some good stuff to say as well. We kind of cover a different area. So on top of that, since this was a while ago, some new things have come out. For example, I mentioned in the show that OpenWRT, the firmware, doesn't have a web interface, when now it does. It's kind of primitive at the moment, but it's definitely a good start. Finally, in honor of my brother, PowerStick, who co-hosts the show with me, he has a little band where he's the drummer and there's a guitarist named Ross, and I figured, hey, we'll just do a few seconds of their music as the intro, so here we go. All right, welcome to another edition of Twat Radio. I am your host, BitViper, and with us today is our co-host, my brother,
PowerStick.
PowerStick, right on. He is going to be here to make sure that when I explain things that they're simple or understandable. If I miss or skip over anything, he'll just ask me some questions and clarify it. So
that's right. I represent all you dull twats out there.
There he is. And if he understands what I'm about to say, that means anyone does.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to be talking about the WRT 54G routers. And everything we're about to say applies most of the time to the GS router as well. The S is double the RAM. So, okay. So what we're going to do, the reason why we're talking about this router is because there's so many cool things that you can do with it. And it runs Linux, as I think most people are aware. Were you aware of that?
I was after you told me.
Okay. That's right. I think I mentioned that before. All right, so the reason why that's neat is because you can actually install your own stuff on top of what's there and also change the way it's set up. And we're going to be talking about the hardware and software setup of it and explain how you can change it to better fit what you want it to do. So I think the first thing we're going to do is dive into the hardware setup. How was it made? And that will kind of help us talk about how to change things later. All right, so the best way to talk about the hardware is to talk about what the Linksys engineers are trying to accomplish. I mean, you've looked at the back of this router, right? There's four ports grouped together.
Mm-hmm.
That's the LAN group. There's the WAN port off to the side, and then there's also the wireless users as well, right?
The two wireless the antenna ports.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's three groups of network of networks that are being juggled by this thing: the LAN, the WAN, and the wireless.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So one way you could solve or put together a unit that could have three different groups is to, for example, have a CPU and then have a wireless chip to take care of the wireless group.
Okay.
And then have an Ethernet chip to take care of the WAN port, and then maybe an Ethernet switch to take care of the four LANs. Okay, so that's one way. And then have them all talk to the CPU and pass packets back and forth through the CPU intelligently.
Okay.
That's one way you could have done it. Well, the folks at Linksys decided to do it a little smarter. Instead of having two different chips for the WAN and the LAN, they actually have one big switch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of neat, and that's where a lot of people get confused, is how does that happen? Well, the switch chip is actually six ports. It's actually able to, if you were just to take it and design your own switch with it, you could make a six-port switch with it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's just a simple switch chip you can buy off the shelf and incorporate into any device you want. Now, what they did is, since it's six ports and they're numbered 0 through 5, which kind of gets confusing as well, but the fifth port is actually hardwired to the CPU directly.
Hmm.
All right, so number 5 is already taken, so that leaves 5 remaining ports, 0 through 4. Okay? Mm-hmm. So what they then did is they actually were able to, this switch chip is actually kind of neat because you can configure it. You can actually tell it, hey, switch, I want you to be broken up into smaller groups. Instead of one group of six, I want you to actually be two or three groups of, you know, two or three ports or whatever it is that you want. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so by breaking it up, you're actually carving it up into virtual switches or what they're actually called VLANs.
But no more than the five.
Exactly.
You could have a group of zero and one, and then a group of two through four.
Yeah, any combination you want. You could have each port have be its own VLAN if you really wanted to. But the caveat is if two people or if two ports are from different VLANs, then traffic won't flow between them automatically by the switch anyway.
Mm.
Okay, so breaking it up into VLANs allows you to kind of make your own groups and that are separate. Now, you might be asking yourself, okay, great, you've cut up the switch into different groups. How do you make those groups talk to each other in a controlled, intelligent way? Because you might want some kind of sharing. And the way is, remember, we have that the sixth port, port number five, is directly connected to the CPU.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens is all traffic that the switch can't take care of, you know, for example, if some traffic comes in on VLAN 0, for example, say the first VLAN, and it doesn't know what to do with it because there's nobody on VLAN 0 that it doesn't match a destination,
mm-hmm.
then it'll take that packet and pass it to the CPU and say, I don't know what to do with it because I don't have anyone on VLAN 0 that is, has the IP address that this guy's looking for.
Okay.
All right, so it passes it to the CPU, and it does that for all the different VLANs through that port number 5.
Okay.
Now you might be asking yourself, if you got all these packets coming through port number 5 into the CPU, how does the CPU know which VLAN it's coming from? Because that's kind of important, right? In order to make its decisions about, you know, that you tell it, you know, I want VLAN 0 and 1 to be kept separate, for example, and maybe allow something, traffic to go one way from VLAN 0 to VLAN 2, for example. These are arbitrary rules. But if you want to add those rules, you need the CPU to understand what VLAN each packet came from that it's seeing.
Some sort of ID?
Exactly. And what actually happens is the switch, before it sends the packet to the CPU, it does what's called tagging. It tags the packet. So it just basically says, this packet came from VLAN 0, Mr. CPU. Here you go. Do whatever you want with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the
mm-hmm.
CPU takes the packet, takes the tag off, and just pretends like it got it from the VLAN directly.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So that's a clever way of allowing up to, I guess, five different VLANs to be connected to the CPU. Instead of using five different chips, it's using one switch that's using tagging. Understand what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I don't understand what this allows. Is this good for things down the line?
Absolutely. Okay. The reason why we did this is because, remember, we have a WAN port, and we have four LAN ports that act differently from each other. For
mm-hmm.
example, the four LAN ports are allowed to talk amongst themselves.
Yeah.
And then the WAN port is handled differently. Your internet connection goes into that, and then there's this IP sharing, you know, masquerading thing, or NAT firewall.
Okay.
Yeah. So those rules are added because, and the only reason these rules work is because they're separate. So traffic won't automatically flow between the WAN and the LAN port. The switch stops that because there's virtual LANs there.
Okay.
All right. So that's how it ships from the factory. Is you have VLAN 0 is the four LAN ports. So they'll all talk to each other. Even if you screw up the router and the CPU dies or something, if the switch chip is still active, those four ports can communicate with each other.
Okay.
All right. Then there's the fifth port. The fifth port, port number 4, which is connected to the WAN port. That's its own separate VLAN just by itself. And that's called VLAN 1. So we have VLAN 0, which is the LAN, and VLAN 1, which is the WAN port.
By default, this is what
this
we
is.
Have.
Yeah, this is what happens when you buy it from the factory.
Okay.
All right.
So I'm assuming you're going to have some interesting stuff we can do.
Absolutely. All right. So finally, we have the wireless chip, and that's connected to the CPU as well. So the only way for traffic to cross from the wireless group into the LAN port or into the LAN switch
mm-hmm.
is through the CPU. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay. So the way it ships from the factory is that the CPU knows to bridge the wireless chip to VLAN 0, which is the LAN users.
The group of the four ports. On
exactly.
The
all can become one giant switch, if you will. So traffic's allowed to cross between them freely, which is what you'd want in a normal router, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want all your users behind the firewall, a.k.a. the LAN 0 guys and the wireless guys, to be able to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, so they call that bridge 0, BR 0. So again, VLAN 0 belongs to the bridge, and the wireless chip, wireless okay. users, all of them. Okay, and then VLAN 1, which is the WAN port, is not bridged because that would, you know, then they'd all be the same. What it does is it uses rules and IP tables. The CPU has rules inside of it that basically do the IP masquerading, where you have one internet address to many, you know, sharing one internet IP address to many local IP addresses. It does those kind of rules between the WAN port and the bridge. Okay? That's really all there is to it. So what's neat, though, is, for example, say, you know, my router right around the corner here, I don't use it to do IP masquerading, the IP address sharing. So in other words, I don't need that WAN port, right?
Yeah.
So what I do is I can actually make that WAN port belong to the bridge as well. So I make VLAN 1 belong to the bridge, and now all the ports are the same way. So it's useful. It's like one giant switch now.
So now you got five instead of four.
Exactly. That all behave the same way. So you can do that. Or if you wanted to, you could carve it up into smaller VLANs and have like port number one go to your kid's room, say, and have that, you know, deactivate at 8 p.m. or something.
Yeah,
or,
totally.
Or filter out porn or whatever it is you want to do.
No prawn for the kiddies.
Exactly.
That's really interesting. So yeah. you can assign different IP tables and different rules.
It's
whatever
all
you can
done
do.
Through IP tables, exactly. You can say VLAN 0 is allowed everything that you want. That would be your port.
Yeah.
VLAN 1 is your kids, which is basically nothing. Like a very few. You can say only allow it from these IP addresses. You could, anyone who knows IP tables, which is like the Linux filtering scheme, knows, you know, all the things you can do with this.
So there's one thing you haven't really mentioned outright yet is the and I'm sure you'll get to
sure.
is putting on another firmware onto the router.
Oh yeah, we'll talk about new firmware.
Because people might not realize that there is Linux firmware
right.
out there with all the functionality that Linux offers.
Exactly. Okay, so I mean, but
that
you
could bring to these virtual LANs. Is
exactly.
What
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But do you understand the hardware setup that we got so far and
yeah,
the software?
Yeah.
Okay.
We got virtual LAN for the LAN ports, virtual LAN for the WAN port.
Exactly.
The CPU.
So
does
they're
everything.
Separate. Yeah,
yeah, they're separate by the rules of the CPU.
Exactly, which are the IP tables rules. Yeah,
and then you can, when you want to start messing around, start applying those rules wherever you want.
Exactly,
or take them away.
Right, exactly. So, you know, for example, the four ports that belong to VLAN 0, what is crucial to understand is that if you're communicating between two different ports in VLAN 0, you know, the LAN ports, the CPU doesn't see those packets because the switch knows what to do with those packets. It says, oh, I'm getting stuff in from port 1 that I know goes to port 2. I'll just send it on to port 2.
Huh.
It doesn't go through the CPU. The only reason, the only way packets get to the CPU is if the switch doesn't know what to do with the packets. Because
that's interesting.
All right? So that comes back to that explanation of why even if the CPU is dead, you can still use it as a four-port switch.
How that worked.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so that's the hardware setup and the firmware setup. So let's talk a little bit about the firmwares that are out there. The first one is the, there's kind of a basic one called HyperWRT. It was started quite a while ago, but it doesn't have a lot of functionality. The main reason people use it is for just being able to change the antenna power of the unit, so you can have your WRT cover.
Which is actually it's pretty cool. I mean, I personally want more functionality, but I know
if
I buy a router
in
the box, I wanted to turbocharge it a little bit.
Sure.
And you have to be careful, though, because you can burn out the antenna.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a good point, because the default power is 28 milliwatts, I think. Is that right?
That sounds about
right. I think that's what we saw.
It might even be 18.
It could be
18. I think you're right, though. It's 28.
Okay, 28. And you can go all the way up to something like 230 or whatever.
Yeah, you can crank it.
But you know what? There's two reasons why you don't want to do that. The first one is if you go past 60 or so, you don't really get too much of a difference, I've noticed, in the connection rate.
Huh.
You know, the RSSI, which is the signal strength for, you know, that your laptop might have far away, it doesn't seem to go up too much once you go after 60 or 70. The other thing, because what happens is the noise in the circuitry also gets amplified.
That's right.
So that what you really want is the signal to noise ratio, and that doesn't get better when you increase it too much. The other reason, of course, is because you'll burn your router. If you go up over 60 or 70,
right.
A lot of people will notice their wireless chips will just die because they're being overburned.
Which we've had happen.
Which has happened in our place. We've got.
But the cool thing is, like you said, though, since there's the different hardware on the board, you can still at least use
exactly
the
yeah.
four ports and the
four LAN
port and all that
still
stuff.
There, exactly. And the CPU is still there to make decisions between them. So you can still have a router,
yeah.
you know, a WAN, just without a wireless chip. Okay, so HyperWT, it's okay. Next thing I want to talk about is FaceSoft. And FaceSoft is, I hate these guys because these guys took a GPL firmware. See, Linksys had to release their firmware, and people, that's why people have been able to improve upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to because it's GPL. It's the, you know, Linux code. And so FaceSoft took it, made it better, and then released it under the GPL, but basically they said you can't download it unless you join our subscription for $20 a year, and then you're not allowed to redistribute it. Mm-hmm. If we find you redistributing it, you're off the team, and you can't download it anymore.
Which,
and you're banned.
Which is, in a way, sort of legal for them to do.
You can do that.
But is really against the ethic and the whole idea.
Exactly. So don't support them. Don't give them any of your money is the lesson for today.
But
if you don't learn anything else with this speech, stay away from FaceSoft. I think we got that point across. What do you think?
I think so.
Okay,
but,
cool.
But it brings to the fork point, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, what's nice is that DD. So this new guy. The good news is we don't need FaceSoft anymore. This guy called Brainslayer, who's in Europe, just took this FaceSoft firmware and just ran like hell with it. He added so much to it that FaceSoft doesn't have in their firmware. And in fact, he's rewritten it so much that the guy even says there's really not much FaceSoft code in it anymore. And so that's the firmware I use, or we use all over the place here. We have a whole bunch of routers, by the way, a lot of bridges and stuff. If you're
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Know what a bridge is.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, he's done a great job, and I really suggest you support him. I've given him $20 through donations, and he even sells shirts if you're interested. So just to keep him coding, so I really encourage that. All these firmwares I've talked about so far, so HyperWRT, FaceSoft, don't buy, and then DDWRT are GUI-based. That means you got this nice web page graphics that look awesome, and you can easily change them.
It's slick. The DDWRT is so slick, easy to use.
It's got skins
awesome
now, too, so you can change colors on it, right?
Remember? Yeah, which is actually helpful.
It really is.
We have a bunch of different routers, and we can visually, recognize.
Exactly.
ID them.
The red one is the base one,
yeah,
and the,
totally.
And the green
one
is the one far away. Yeah, so it's really nice. It's a nice feature, and FaceSoft doesn't have it. Yeah, okay. So those are all GUI-based. The one last one we're going to talk about is OpenWRT, which is not GUI-based. It's text. It's basically hardcore Linux, bare bones, installed, and it doesn't take up much space, which is kind of nice. So you can install a lot of other things on top of it.
No HTML code and all that stuff.
No, there's no web. No web.
No fluff.
Code. All right, so real quickly, let's talk about DDWRT. He's on version 20. Actually, he's on version 24 now, beta, but the latest release is version 23, and it works great. It could do everything that the regular version of the stock firmware can do, of course. One of the main cool things about it, though, is something called WDS mode, which you and I have done a lot.
A lot.
what this does is allows you to bridge WRTs together. And you can, what's neat about this is that you can do any kind of topology you want, right? We can do a star topology where one's in the middle and you have a whole bunch around it. Or you can have a linear topology, which goes like a daisy chain, one to the next, to the next, to the next. You can even do a mesh.
Really quick, we didn't really say what bridge is.
Oh, yeah. Bridge basically is like having two WRTs connected via an Ethernet cable in terms of being able – they're on the same – they're like one giant switch in a way. But it's using the wireless mechanism to connect each other. So it's an invisible cable. But it's exactly what you want. If you have like an Xbox in the corner of your room and you want to connect that to your network, that, you know, and your access points on the other side, you know, you don't want to have a big long wire across. So you can actually...
We've all had the big, long, ugly wire.
Absolutely. And, you know, being married now, that's not an option. So you can get a WRT and, flash DDWRT on it, and you'll now have WDS mode, and you can combine... You can bridge the two.
Which is really cool.
It's just slick, yeah. And by the way, Linksys does sell a bridge product. It's like the WRT11 or WET 11, I forget. And it's like $130 or something. It's a lot more expensive. And that's all it does.
That's funny.
And it's a lot more expensive than the $40 or $50 WRTs we're talking about. So it doesn't make any sense to buy that. Why would you do that when you can get WDS mode with a lot more functionality
for
a lot
WDS.
Less money.
Interesting.
One neat thing that, you see, WDS mode, a lot of firmwares have it, but one neat thing that DDWRT has is something called a WDS watchdog.
Mm.
And what's nice about that is that you can actually, say you have a simple bridge, two points, you know, a left and a right point. You can have the left WRT, you know, they're both bridged together, but you can have the left one ping the right one, and you can have the right one ping the left one every, you know, time period that you specify. And if the ping fails, it'll reboot itself. And the idea behind that is every blue moon or so, the bridge will go down for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. People speculate it might be a bug in the proprietary Broadcom driver, or it could be a bug in the firmware, who knows. But it doesn't happen often. But when it does, if you have the watchdog enabled, it'll reboot. They'll both eventually reboot and bring themselves up, and you won't even notice it was down. So having that watchdog is pretty cool. Another neat feature is quality of service. So you can actually have, if you have a voice over IP phone, you can protect that bandwidth. You do pay a little, unfortunately, a bandwidth price. Like say you have 2 megabits of download speed. Well, I think it's 20% of that you lose in order to do quality of service, which kind of is unfortunate.
Interesting.
Yeah, it sucks. Another thing you can do is you can mount Samba shares directly to your router. So in other words, if you want to write logs of stuff, you can write to your computer instead of writing to the flash and fill up the memory space.
I mean, if you're like error checking on the router, you can have it logged.
You can route whatever you can log whatever you want over the Samba share, which saves memory, which is nice. The power adjustment, mm-hmm. 28 milliwatts, that's all there.
The transmission power.
Transmission power, yeah. It's got a wake on LAN client. It's got a VPN server and a VPN client. Remember that's how we played Warcraft against each other at one time?
We're using this?
Yeah, we were using VPN.
I did not. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it worked great.
Yeah, it logged right into your...
Exactly.
I was logging into your router?
You were logging my router, not my computer.
Funny.
Yeah.
For some reason, I remember that now. For some reason, I thought I remembered it being a server.
That's how it worked. And it worked fine, right? I mean,
yeah.
you had XP at the time.
Yeah.
And you used that VPN client to just dial right into it, and it worked great.
That's cool.
Yeah. You can do hotspots, which are like using a program called ChiliSpot. You know, if you ever been to Starbucks and the first web page, no matter what you do, is always this one thing that makes you pay or makes you, say, okay, I agree to your conditions.
So you could start a hotspot where the first page you see is the Lemon Party.
If you were so inclined, I suppose you could. If you don't know what Lemon Party is, you're lucky. All right.
Don't look up Lemon Party on Google.
Another neat thing that I actually used a lot in my old job was something called RFlow, which is a program that runs on Windows, but it works with DDWRT by showing you, it's pretty cool, it shows you bar graphs and graphics that show who's logged on, who's using the bandwidth, and everything you'd ever possibly want to know. So it's a neat way of
how much porn is my child downloading?
You can have that too. It's pretty sweet. So anyway, you can use it to assign the VLAN 1, which is the WAN port, to the bridge, so they're all the same, like I described earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a lot of extra features I got listed here, but, I think we've kind of hit a lot of them, so I think we're going to move on. One of the things of...
Did you cover this one? You can change the startup scripts to run other stuff of... Oh, I thought... No, okay, sorry. I thought you said stuff you own.
Oh, no. Okay, so... how do you get this firmware on there? It's really simple.
It's super simple.
You just use the built-in method for upgrading firmware, but instead of using a Linksys upgrade file, you just use DDWRT.
It's awesome. You go to DDWRT.org.
I'm pretty sure it's com.
Download it, and then it's on your desktop. You go to your router.
You flash it, you're done.
It says, where's the file, and bam, it's on there.
Well, some people are afraid to do that because, if you screw it up for whatever reason, I don't know how you could screw that up, but if you did...
Like a loss of power?
Really the only way. Then your router's screwed because it doesn't have a good firmware on it. But even that's okay because if your router has a bad flash and it can't load, it'll actually go into TFTP server mode where it gives itself the IP address of 192.168.1.1, and then you can just TFTP up a new firmware image using that method and you're good to go. Now, the only time that you really are screwed is you successfully flash it, but then you change the settings on it so you can't get into it. So in other words, the firmware is okay,
but the
rules are such that you don't even know what IP address it is, say, or you just can't get into it. You accidentally shut the telnet daemon off and the SSH daemon, or you just can't get into it anymore.
The reset button.
The reset button does work sometimes.
But you had another trick up your sleeve.
There are times there are times where you just really the firmware is in there, but you have to rewrite it. And in order to do that, there's something called shorting the pins. There's a method where you do that, where you actually open up the router, find the flash chip which has the firmware on it, and actually short a couple of the data pins. And that actually makes the router load the software incorrectly, obviously, and then it sees, oh, this is incorrect, so I'm going to go into TFTP server mode. I've done it hundreds of times, unfortunately, and it's worked every time, so don't be afraid to do it.
Huh.
Okay, last firmware we're going to talk about is OpenWRT, which is pretty cool. I think you've seen it, right?
I don't think so, actually.
No? Okay. Well, it's basically, as soon as you install it, you no longer get the GUI. You get the text box. You can telnet into it, or you can SSH into it, whatever you want. And then it's neat because it actually installs a very Debian-like package manager called iPackage, where you can add a whole bunch of packages people have installed. For example, I actually, or people have set up, I installed a package called Ncurses and a game engine called Frots that allowed me to play Zork on my router, which is kind of cool. Brought me back, you know. I don't know why you wouldn't want to run Zork on your own computer instead of, you know,
through your router. Just because you can. I feel like the same like reason why everyone's trying to put Linux on like their microwave.
Absolutely, that's the whole reason. Well, the actual ugly truth, though, is that you can do a lot of stuff in DDWRT that you can do in OpenWRT. You can add your own scripts in DWRT. You can add programs. So, you know, a lot of people are hardcore and say OpenWRT all the way, and, you know, God bless them. But there's very few things.
The only reason I can see as an advantage is the you get more memory.
That's so right. You get a lot more scripts. For example, if you want to install Asterix, I think that – Asterix is that phone server thing.
Yeah, the PBX.
They have a version for the GS, you know, the one with more memory.
Yeah.
So I guess that would only work with OpenWRT.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. By the way, the processor is MIPS-based, so if you want to compile something for it, just compile it for MIPS and then upload it on there, and you're good to go. Okay, so other hardware hacking people have done, instead of just software hacking. By the way, so you can change the VLANs with any of these softwares. You can always telnet into DDWRT and change the settings that way through telnet. You don't have to use the GUI if you don't want to.
You can get your command line if you
want. Exactly, if you want. People have added serial ports. I've done it. Worked just fine. You have to have a chip, actually, that takes the 3.3 volts of the serial port from the router and makes it compatible with the 12 volts of a computer. Otherwise, you'll blow up the router. So you need that.
Brick.
Exactly. And people then have taken that to interface to GPS devices, LCD screens, everything you could ever want. There's even an SD card mod, so you can add SD cards as memory to it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Then you can put
anything. A lot of stuff. Exactly. People use it for logging, for going hacking, and using Kismet to
war driving.
Absolutely. Okay, so
I think it's a hacker's dream.
It really is. I mean, remember...
Because it's Linux-based.
I mean, I might as well talk about this one neat thing we did with OpenWRT.
You totally should, because okay. This is a great example.
Here's an example of how far out there you can exactly. Go. Here's an example of what you can do with a WRT to solve a problem. We live on, or at least you don't used to live, you moved to Berkeley, but I live in a ranch area that is just out of the... in the boonies, where we don't get any good internet access.
It's in what's called BFE.
Yeah, that's... I just got what that meant. We finally managed to set up or to share our neighbor up the hills, his internet connection, because he's on top of his hill and he can see this mountain that gets a radio-based ISP signal. So
he gets faster internet. Otherwise, we're stuck with crappy direct way.
Exactly, which don't get, by the way, even if that's all your only option. It's so damn slow and so damn expensive that...
But you deserve it.
But you deserve it. God, I hate that lady. I'm going to kill her every time I see it. Okay, so we finally shared. Remember, we set up that repeater because we couldn't see him direct line of sight. That solar-powered thing, that was nice.
Yeah, and we could even talk about that after this thing.
Okay. Well, we'll mention briefly what the repeater is. We used two routers in WDS mode, one to link to the neighbor and the other one to link to us, and it was powered via a car battery and a solar cell, right? And it's up there right now. That's how we get our internet.
That's right. We have it's two WRTs,
right?
You said that, and then
they're bridged together with an Ethernet cable to talk to each other.
Yeah,
but then they're the endpoints of two new bridges, one to our neighbors and the other one to us, our barn down here.
So it was cool because we didn't have line of sight to our neighbors to just shoot antennas at each other. Right. So we used two WDRTs to basically bend signal around a hill.
Oh, and we used antennas, by the way. We used those cantennas.
Yeah, cantennas.
Those line of sight things. But even with the cantenna, we had to use the repeaters because of the hill. So so we had this set up. We went to a real pain to get this all working, only to find out that the ISP, the modem that our neighbors used, would freeze every now and then.
Which was awesome.
Oh, that sucked. We had a really well-working network, and we had this problem where it would freeze. And the only way to unfreeze it would be for our neighbors to figure it out that then the connection was down and to unplug it and plug it back in.
Which usually meant we would call them up and bug them.
Exactly.
Say, hey, we're trying to download our porn. Could you please?
I'm not sure if we put it quite that way, but it was somewhat in that.
We're probably more tactful.
Yeah, maybe.
Probably.
All right. So what happened was they went on vacation one time for a week. Remember that? And went out the day they left. So that sucked. And Dad turned off their power and turned it back on.
He
had to give up a really awesome bottle of wine to apologize for that. But anyway, something had to change. All right, we knew this. So what we did was we took a WRT unit and we put OpenWRT on. In fact, we took one that had a busted wireless chip, right? So we weren't sacrificing
much. That's right. We took a wirelessly bricked router.
Exactly. But it still worked, the WAN and LAN ports. Put OpenWRT on it. And then what we did was we plugged the... See, the neat thing about OpenWRT, and DDWRT does this as well, is you can control the DMZ light. That's one of the lights on the front. You can turn it off, on and on. If you're curious, the directory that or the location of that register is /proc, as in processor, /sys, /, and then DIAG, short for diagnose. And you can echo a 1 to it to turn the light on and echo a 0 to it to turn the light off. Well, then we added a relay. We added a resistor. The base went to that light, and then the rest of it went to a circuit that fed 12 volts from the router to a relay. And the relay controlled the voltage to a 110-volt box that we plugged into the wall. So mm-hmm. In other words, we were able to use the WRT and OpenWRT inside of it to turn on and off this 110-volt box just by turning on the light.
Turn on and off the modem that kept going.
Yeah, we plugged the modem into the 110-volt box.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, and then what happened was we plugged the modem, the output, the Ethernet output, into it, into the WRT, and then from there to the rest of the network. So the WRT was first in line to see the modem, so it was a direct connection to it.
And you set it to just sit there and ping?
Exactly. So we wrote a script that auto-loaded at boot up to ping the modem every, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, something like that. And it actually pinged 4 times, because every now and then one would fail, even if it was up. So we pinged 4 times, and if all 4 failed, it would actually turn off the DMZ light, which in effect turned off or unplugged the modem for whatever amount of time we said, and then bring it back up after a few seconds, and then ping it again. And if it's pinged, and it would just go back to normal mode where it would scan for future down periods. And it worked, right? Remember, we put it down and up. In fact, it even would log when it would when this would happen to a web page that was served by OpenWRT, so we can see what the status is, what's happened, just by looking at the browsing to the WRT's web page. So
yeah, I'll tell you if it's gone down
exactly,
what time it did,
and then what time it came back up, so we know exactly what's going on. So that was a really cool instance of OpenWRT helping us out.
And that's the coolest thing about that is that I mean, you can turn on and off anything.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a modem.
You could tell that you could plug in anything into a box like that.
And it could be on the other side of the world.
Yeah, you tell that in. It's like, hey, I want to turn off my, I don't know.
Right. And you know what's also kind of neat is that the reset button is actually configurable. It doesn't have to reboot the router.
That's cool.
Yeah, it actually is just a regular input line that's monitored by the CPU.
Can you do that button on the front too, the setup button?
I think so. I don't know much about that button, but I think you can. I'm pretty sure you can control that orange light on the newer ones.
Okay.
And the white one as well. There's a white light in there sometimes. So anyway, you can monitor the reset button as well. And in other words, there's usually a reset daemon that just sits there and monitors the reset button, and when it sees it pressed in, it'll reset the router. Well, you don't have to run that. You can just get rid of that and put in your own little daemon that's just basically a script that runs forever, and have it monitor the reset button and then do something of your choosing mm-hmm. when it's pressed in. So you can take the reset button lines out and monitor something, like when your cat comes in the door or something, you can monitor that, whatever it is that you want, and then it's really the possibilities are limitless.
Yeah, it's just whatever you want to come up with.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, in fact, as you know, we're going to monitor the water tank at the top of the hill using an AVR chip.
And that's what's so cool. I mean, you got this thing that can through the light or even through a serial port.
Yeah,
right?
Remember, I added the serial port to that, and then that's going to connect to the AVR chip, which has a whole bunch of input output pins, mm-hmm. like a lot more than WRT.
And then it's got wireless sensors built in, so
exactly.
You can shoot this information somewhere.
Exactly. So you don't have to be next to it or have a wire go up to it. You just need power in that area or a solar panel. Right?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally wireless. I think that's awesome.
Cool. All right. I think we've covered pretty much everything.
I think you pretty
much
covered it all.
Oh, no. There was a joint effort here. Any questions? Oh, one last thing. Unfortunately, Linksys just couldn't leave a good thing alone, and they keep changing the damn router. There's 10 versions of just the G alone, believe it or not. And the newest version is a version 5, which has half the memory of all the other ones, and it doesn't run Linux, so it's not upgradable. So if you get a version 5, you're screwed. You can't do what we're just talking about.
How do you find what version does it say?
Yes, if you're at a Walmart or whatever, and you're looking at the box, and you want to know if it's a version, you know, if it's a good version or not, look at the serial number. The first four digits tell you what's going on. The first three are always the same, CDF, Charlie Delta Foxtrot. The fourth digit, though, tells you what version it is. And if the fourth digit's a number, you're good, because that means it's either a version 1 all the way up to a version 3.1. If it's the letter A, you're also good, because that's a version 4. But if it's a B as in Bob, that's a version 5. So just that's bad. So just easy to remember, if the fourth digit is B, B as in bad, don't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to talk about. Oh, there's also a new model called the WRT54GL that is specifically Linux, you know, guaranteed to be on there. Unfortunately, they're charging people like $30-$40 more for the L, so that kind of sucks.
But you get more memory.
No, you get the same memory. It's the same thing as a version 4 in terms of memory and everything.
Oh, that's messed up.
That's what they're doing.
I thought you said there was more memory.
So no.
They're just charging $30 to do what you could use to do with the
exactly.
54.
As far as I know, I think that's the only, it's basically like a version 4, mm-hmm. but more money. That's why you can use the serial number trick to get the cheaper one if you
okay.
want. In fact, I went to Walmart and I found a whole bunch that were unwrapped. Or two that were unwrapped, and I bought
someone
those
opened
two.
The boxes. And
exactly. I think they returned them because they had no idea what they're doing, and I bought them because they were version like 2.0 and 3.1.
Nice.
And there was an unopened 4.0, so I bought that one as well to replace the bad one at the top.
And maybe a good thing to say, a last thing, Walmart sells these, I think the cheapest I've heard, because you
yeah.
can get them at Amazon for like 55
That's
or
a good
60
point.
Bucks.
They go on sale on and off.
CompUSA is like $70.
Oh, yeah. Never, don't buy from Comp or Staples or Radio Shack. Those guys are all, they suck. $47 is what I found at Walmart the other day. So,
really?
I mean, it's hard to beat.
That's not bad at all. I bet you Newegg has a good price.
Okay. All right, so I think that's all we have to say about the WRT54G. Thanks for listening. Phil, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Hey,
it was a lot of fun.
No problem. It's good times.
And maybe we'll do another one sometime.
Good things.
All right, guys. Take care. Happy hacking.